Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
It's almost like it's open season here on journalists. There's a situation of guaranteed impunity.
Journalist Shannon Young has been providing breaking news reports from Oaxaca, Mexico, during years of change and upheaval there. She joins us to talk about her breaking news stories in context. In San Juan Capola, she reported on a paramilitary siege that's endangered civilians. Efforts at peace convoys have been made, but all of them failed, and people have died in the attempts. Shannon Young's stories are best understood in the context of history, as in San Juan Capola, where there's now a three-way factional struggle, exacerbated by the politics of poverty versus wealth. We'll also hear about the threat to journalists.
San Juan Capola is, as you said, the ceremonial center of the lower Triqui region. Triqui is one of the 16 indigenous groups present here in Oaxaca. They have a relatively small territory in the middle of the Mixteca region, but the area around Capola itself contains the best agricultural land in the area. It has some very rich pine forests and is rumored to contain incredible mineral wealth. Now, this wealth has not been at least publicly explored, and I'm unaware of any kind of mining company that has a stake already down on it. But in documents that I've looked at that are from Mexico's geological survey, it really does look like they have some incredible minerals there. Of course, you know, you have silver and gold, but there are things even just beyond that. As you trace the history of this conflict back, it really can go all the way back to the War for Independence from Spain. Interestingly enough, Mexico just a few weeks ago celebrated the bicentennial of this Declaration of Independence, and the Triqui Nation was key in the regional fight against the Spanish royal forces. Now, in exchange for their fighting in this cause, exchange for throwing their resources towards independence, in payment, they received a certain amount of autonomy, recognition of their Triqui Nation. That means they were able to govern their own territory, make determinations about their own mineral wealth, who owned what piece of property. They had a county seat designation. Here, the municipio is the basis of local power, controls land, titles, controls the distribution of resources at a municipal level. So it's an important unit politically. Now, in 1948, the designation of municipio, of their own county, was taken away under the justification that there was so much violence in this region that the Triquis just couldn't possibly govern themselves. What had happened before that, this violence just didn't come out of nowhere. Local caciques, which are land bosses that have a stake in dividing and conquering the Triqui Nation or in creating conflict in order to have some sort of financial gain out of it. What had been happening in the Triqui region prior to 1948 was that there had been emphasis on coffee cultivation. There's also an endemic type of banana that's grown only in that region as well. And instead of getting cash payment for their goods, they were paid oftentimes in alcohol and in firearms. So when you have a mixture of alcohol and weapons, that's a recipe for some violence, and that violence did happen. And instead of stepping in to mediate it, as a responsible government would do, they let the situation fester, took away the designation that allowed the Triqui Nation to have control over their territory and their resources and their natural wealth, and divided it up among four mestizo municipalities. Mestizo is people who are non-indigenous, who are either a mix or more towards the traditional criollo class that has long dominated economic wealth here in Mexico. So their territory was divided up and they basically lost all political power. Add that to a military invasion literal aerial bombardment in 1956. There was a reaction in the Treaty territory to losing their power, and the army moved in. And as far as I know, it's the only example of an aerial bombardment, the Mexican army carrying out an aerial bombardment prior to the Zapatista uprising of 1994. So after decades of military occupation, the army moved out in the 1990s, but right around the same time as a paramilitary group was forming. This is the Ubisort. They're the ones who are accused of carrying out the ambush of the peace caravan that was headed to San Juan Copala, specifically to investigate charges that the civilian population was under paramilitary assault. And before even reaching the town, armed men opened fire on this caravan, killing two people. One is a recognized Mexican activist, and another was an international observer from Finland. And those crimes have gone unpunished, like every other murder in the Treaty region.
And when did that attack take place, Shannon Young?
April 27th of 2010 of this year.
Did people start right up again, or what was the consequence of this attack?
Well, first they called for punishment for the aggressors, to have some sort of justice. You have two people who were murdered. As I said, one who's a recognized, internationally recognized Mexican human rights defender, and then an international observer. These are not the profile of people who are usually murdered in the Treaty region. And so it was thought that it might have a bit more of a political impact, or at least a political cost. And for that reason, there might be a better chance that the aggressors would be brought to justice. Well, that hasn't happened. But there was an attempt later to organize a second caravan. The second caravan was bringing supplies from Mexico City and from Oaxaca City. They converged in the Mixteca region before heading into the Treaty region. And they were also unsuccessful in bringing the aid to the community. It's important to mention that the community itself was under a paramilitary blockade, like no vehicles could come in or come out. Once they got to Juxloaca, which is the mestizo municipal seat of governing this Treaty region, they were met up with a huge convoy of state police, and the state police basically tried to impede their pass. People got down from the buses and started to attempt to access the region on foot. The police relented, let them get back up on their buses, but once the caravan was inside the Treaty region, they said, "We're not going to allow you to continue." So there have been two caravans that have attempted to go to the Treaty region, and none have been able to make it to San Juan Copala. There was a third caravan that was supposed to leave from San Juan Copala in August, and it was to take civilians out of the line of fire. It was billed as an all-women's caravan, but the intent was to take women and children who wanted to evacuate the region, to allow them to leave together safely. It had to be canceled just days before it was set to leave because the people who were organizing the trip were killed in an ambush as they traveled between neighborhoods in the Treaty region to get a census of who all wanted to go on this caravan to leave the region. So three people died in that attack, and it effectively canceled the caravan.
And you've also reported that the governor, I believe, has ties to this Ubisort paramilitary. Who are they, and what other kinds of things do they do?
There's not so much a direct allegation between the governor, Ulises Ruiz, and this particular paramilitary group, so much as there's a connection between the party of the governor and this paramilitary group. Ubisort was formed in 1994, just months after the start of the indigenous uprising in Chiapas, Mexico, which Chiapas shares a border with Oaxaca. Some analysts have said that it seemed almost like a preventative measure on the part of the government to squash any kind of autonomy movement that might have the same characteristics as the Zapatista uprising. Incidentally, San Juan Copala has styled their autonomous municipality on the municipalities that were established by the Zapatista rebels. This particular group has conservative politics. You know, here in the state of Oaxaca, the PRI has been in control for 8 consecutive decades, so its influence stretches into just about every aspect of socioeconomic life here. And when you're talking about the countryside, that includes the distribution of resources in public programs intended for rural populations, especially for rural poor populations. Mexico does not have the same kind of weapons laws as the U.S. You know, you can't walk into a gun store here and walk out with an AK-47 like you can in the state of Texas. So it's obvious that there's somebody providing funds and weapons and bullets to this group that's really in a rather isolated rural area. The weapons that they are using are for the exclusive use of the military. That's actually a crime here in Mexico if you own a weapon that's designated for the exclusive use of the military. It's a federal crime, which is why people have pointed out that the federal government could intervene. This isn't just a state-level problem. The federal government has all the legal tools at its disposal to walk into the region and execute warrants having to do with possession of firearms that are for the exclusive use of the military. Now, the Ubisoft is said to have not very many followers. There was a split within the Ubisoft, from what I understand, when the residents of San Juan Copala declared the town an autonomous municipality. It's important to say, like, as you mentioned, there's a three-way factional struggle. The other faction is the MULT, the Movement for the Unification of the Triqui Struggle. Now, the roots of the MULT were as a leftist grassroots organization to lobby for the benefit of the Triqui people and the Triqui nation. In the 1980s, the organization underwent a really vicious targeting of its ranks, and some of its best visionaries were murdered. And the people who stepped in to fill the power vacuum are considered to be, let's say, less visionary than their predecessors and more opportunists. And in 2003, they formed a political party, the Partido de Unidad Popular, which some say has ultimately benefited the PRI by siphoning off leftist votes from opposition candidates. The MULT is also considered to be supporting the Ubisoft in the effort of suffocating this autonomy movement in San Juan Copala, because both organizations lost members to this third group, the MULTI, the group in charge of the autonomous municipality of San Juan Copala. Both groups had factions that splintered off and formed this autonomous municipality. So both groups have a reason to punish former members, shall we say. One was in charge of blocking the road that led to Putla, and the other was in charge of blocking the road that led to Huxlahuaca. So the town ended up being surrounded and ultimately suffocated.
What about corporate or political outside influences? You know, we've often seen these struggles for land and resources get blown up by the fact that others take an interest in them.
Yeah. I asked the spokeswoman for the protest encampment here in Oaxaca City. It's a camp of displaced persons. So why so much viciousness in the actions taken against the autonomous municipality? What is there in that region that would make these groups act with such force? What's their interest? And she said, even we don't know. We who are from there, even we don't know what is it that's there that makes them go after this particular piece of territory with so much violence. As I mentioned before, I mean, it appears by Mexican Geological Survey maps that the town is literally situated on top of a gold mine. So that's one line of investigation. And again, we're talking about the best agricultural lands in the area. And there's a long tradition here in Mexico of just land bosses, caciques, who accumulate political power by controlling vast amounts of territory. And the richer the territory, the better. And it almost sounds absurd to just go after rich farmland, but that's a huge chunk of the history of Central America. I mean, just going after rich farmland that produces bananas, which is the case in Copala, bananas and coffee. Coffee supposedly is the second most traded legal substance after oil.
Shannon, the headlines about Mexico that we tend to see here in North America are, of course, about the rising number of killings of civilians and also of reporters, many of them now trying to get visas to escape the violence and come to the U.S. But why do you think it is that we're not getting the big picture here, you know, or even mention of this Ubisoft paramilitary and the role of the police?
First off, the reason why paramilitary violence isn't covered, I think, is also, you could say the same for why government corruption isn't as covered as it should be, given how it permeates to just about like every level of bureaucracy. It's the same reason why connections between the drug cartels and government are not reported as they should be. It's self-censorship and it's fear on the part of the media. I could say personally that I've felt intimidated on several occasions just following this Copala story. I'll go out to do interviews and people will take my picture. I mean, in a way that makes it clear that what I'm doing as a reporter is why they're taking my picture. And I've spoken to people from a group that's been accused of paramilitarism and was surrounded, and it was a really tense situation. I've found, for example, at some of the interviews I did were involving people giving answers in the Copala variant of the Triqui language, and I had to seek out an interpreter, and the interpreter was also very nervous, wanted to, you know, make sure that I had that I was going to give her total confidentiality because she fears for her safety as well. She doesn't want to be seen as taking a part in this conflict, even if it's something as benign as giving an accurate translation of an interview. The fear definitely permeates because you know that you're touching a topic that isn't meant to be touched, that interests don't want you touching. And I guess the polite way of asking you to drop it is to intimidate you. And the not so polite way is to take physical force against reporters. And as history has shown here in Mexico, murders, kidnappings, beatings, whatever, targeting reporters, you know, there's a guarantee that it's going to go unpunished. And you don't even need to be somebody with really high-level official connections. I mean, you can just be the hired gun of some rancher who's out to confiscate territory. So really, I mean, anybody, it's almost like it's open season here on journalists. There's a situation of guaranteed impunity.
Well, Shannon Young, we all remember the story of journalist Brad Will, you know, famously taping his own death in Mexico and killed in October of 2006, so 4 years ago. We're hearing that things have gotten so much harder, though, and I'm wondering, was it some of the same issues that Brad Will was trying to get at that are at the heart of the struggle now, you know, as you report from Oaxaca and as others try to cover Mexico?
We're covering the struggles of people from the ground up. People here, to improve their situation, oftentimes have to take the situation into their own hands and construct the conditions that they want in their own life. And sometimes that runs counter to what I guess we could call it the system's plans for people who are poor in a developing country. The Brad Will case is another case of a reporter who was murdered in front of witnesses, as you said, famously taping his own death. And even with that mountain of compelling evidence, the people who witnesses fingered as being responsible are still walking free. There was a man who was arrested for Brad Will's murder, but he was a scapegoat, and ultimately he had to be freed. You know, if you almost insist on having justice, if you insist on having a murder prosecuted, it's more likely in Mexico that the government will find a scapegoat than go after the culprit, even if there is video and photographic evidence of who pulled the trigger.
What keeps you in this Oaxaca region of Mexico, given the difficulties of reporting from there?
Well, I see, I think as a reporter, there's a basic instinct to really want to go after a story that needs to be told. There's just something that, you know, moth to a flame about it. You know it's dangerous, but sometimes you're just so either outraged or motivated or, you know, compelled to find justice that you really kind of don't even think about the personal risks. And sometimes the risks are right up in your face, as I've said. I've felt more intimidation from unidentified strangers working on this Kopala story than anything else. And that includes, you know, the political uprising of 2006 when things were really tense here. I like living in Mexico. You know, I'm part of a binational family. My husband's Mexican. Our daughter was born here. So it's part of who I am at this point. And there are a lot of stories here that need to be told that aren't being told. And it may seem almost like, well, what does this have to do with me or anybody else from the U.S.? But there's so many connections and sometimes invisible connections between U.S. interests and really how it plays out on the ground in the form of paramilitary violence, in the form of impunity, in the form of displacing indigenous people from resource-rich areas. And there is a connection, and I think that if I can play a part in making that connection understood, then, I don't know, maybe I can feel like I've served a higher purpose. I don't know.
Let's talk about the other danger in this area, which is landslides. We just read about one in Tlahuito-Tlapec, and a report by Kristen Bricker in the Latin America Bureau, this is an online news page funded by Oxfam, cites deforestation as a major cause. What's being done to address this problem, and can NGOs get in and help, or is that something that's a problem too?
Yes, NGOs do have a role, but they have to understand that local people should be in control of their own destiny and should have priority in the decision making of where resources should be designated. I don't know necessarily what the case is in Tlahuitoltepec, how resources are being distributed. They actually got world attention because of what was initially understood to be a far greater, far deadlier landslide than what it turned out to be. But in the same mountain range, in the Zapotec region of the Sierra Norte, there are entire communities that have been cut off, that have had vehicle access cut off since Hurricane Frank passed. And that's in late August. It shows the larger corruption here and institutional abandonment and neglect of some of the most marginalized areas. It's almost like, you know, you have to accept as a fact of life, if you go and you live in a rural community, which in Oaxaca means a rural indigenous community most times, that you're going to be cut off from the outside world during the rainy season due to the shoddy construction of roads. And, I mean, there's some really basic things, and this is actually like a story I'm working on right now for The World, the PRI program, The World. Just really basic measures that should be taken in any civil engineering project like a highway to mitigate erosion, to eliminate to at least lessen the probability of landslides. And that means, you know, building retention walls, you know, when you're carving a road through a steep slope, or to have gabions. You'll see them sometimes like in bridges or on highways in mountainous areas. They're like rock-filled cages, you know. They let the water pass through, but they keep the sand back. They keep the earth back. Just simple, simple things like that are, you know, civil engineering 101 are never done here. And that's because so much of the public works budget goes through this system of compadrismo, you know, where if you're a politically connected owner of a cement factory, you know, you're going to get this no-bid contract to sell materials to the public works department. And there's no penalty if you thin out the concrete with sand in order to, you know, sell more and pocket the difference. I mean, the public works office here is just famously, famously corrupt, not only for no-bid contracts to political allies, but also for its really shoddy construction. I mean, one of the reasons why the army couldn't get to Tlahuitoltepec for hours is because this new bridge that leads to the region was just completely broken by a rush of water and earth. I mean, to build a bridge, you have to use a specific type of concrete, like Portland cement, to be able to withstand, you know, the weight of cars and to withstand a possible flood. And it just, I mean, that bridge isn't even 3 years old, and it was gone. There wasn't just one landslide in Tlahuitoltepec. I mean, it was multiple landslides along the road. And I've traveled that road many times over the course of many years, and it's a really dangerous road. And there is no basic protection to avoid completely foreseeable events like landslides.
Where specifically is Tlahuitoltepec?
Tlahuitoltepec is in the Mije region, which is northeast of Oaxaca City, about 2.5 hours northeast, up in the mountains. And these mountains are, you know, definitely steep. So, you know, there is the risk of a landslide just due to the angle of the ground. Now, of course, like in most areas where landslides do occur, deforestation definitely had an impact. Most of these landslides occurred in areas that were populated, that are used for agricultural purposes, you know, where trees have been cleared in order to, you know, plant cornfields, for example. But it's overwhelmingly agriculture and small animal breeding, which take a toll on the land itself. A lot of the areas in the Sierra Norte, Zapoteco, Mije, Chinanteco, a lot of this area has been losing, I mean, like hemorrhaging its youth population since NAFTA. The reason for that is because NAFTA did away with base prices for Mexican staple agricultural goods like corn and beans. You know, farmers could no longer get a guaranteed minimum price. Add that to being in direct competition with industrial scale subsidized U.S. agribusiness. And what the U.S. has been doing is they buy up the excess corn, subsidized corn, and instead of just storing it in granaries in the U.S., they, you know, sell it on the Mexican market. Of course, corn is the most important crop. So when your domestic producers are unable to sell their product at more than the cost of production, there's really no financial incentive to stay in the corn business. The interesting thing about Tlahuitoltepec is that it has retained its youth population. I mean, it's something immediately that you see. You know, you get there and there's just there are kids everywhere. And what's helped to keep them there is the music. There's this really, really strong musical tradition.
Everyone stays home because everyone plays a musical instrument and they enjoy it so much, according to your story in PRI, right?
Well, the Mijes have always had a really well-known reputation as being musicians, and, you know, there's a whole tradition of composers in the Mije region. And, I mean, the musicians, that's what the town is famous for. I mean, there's estimates that as many as 75% of the people there know how to read music. It's considered a basic part of literacy.
Journalist Shannon Young is headlines producer for Free Speech Radio News. She reports from Oaxaca, Mexico for FSRN and also PRI, Public Radio International, and their program, The World. Shannon Young, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Dori.
And the music you're listening to in the background, Avión de Candoy. This is Banda Region Mije. It's available on MySpace. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated nationally with Pacifica Network. Our website is talknationradio.org. Underwriting for the program is brought to you by jeremyrhammond.com. Political analysis from outside the standard framework. Jeremy R. Hammond is founder and editor of foreignpolicyjournal.com and a recipient of the Project Censored 2010 Award. At jeremyrhammond.com, you'll find stories now about U.S. policy on Iran, negotiating with the Taliban, Gaza, Israel, and more.